Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today, we have Amanda Waltz.
Hello, Brian.
Hello. We also have Bill Graham.
Woo!
Yeah! How's everyone doing today?
Pretty good.
Great. Yeah.
Sweet. I'm moving at a sloth-like pace today.
Yeah, no, this is like our, I think we're working off of our like third straight day of rain here in the D.C. area. After a brief reprieve from what had been a 17-day streak of precipitation, so.
Yeah, same here. Pittsburgh's been pretty wet.
Guys. It was terrible.
Ugh.
My birthday was yesterday, same day as a baby shower.
Oh, awesome. Wow. Yeah. Was, so it was a combo baby shower birthday party?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's not awkward for everybody.
So you also
Why
got a onesie, Brian.
For anybody?
Usually it's awkward for males to attend a baby shower.
Bill, you're living in the 20th century. I've been to like
I said
seven
usually.
Baby showers.
I have been to many female only baby showers.
Yep.
One of which was also a tea party.
I don't want to be the guy to break this to you, Amanda, but that's super sexist.
It's pretty sexist.
Yeah.
I know. I didn't organize them
as a culture.
Anyway. Are you sure?
Am I sure?
No, I'm talking to Amanda.
Amanda's sure that she didn't organize them.
I couldn't organize anything. I could barely organize my own wedding, so.
Oh, my God. All right. Well, today we will be talking about The Nice Guys, the newest film from writer-director Shane Black, starring Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling. Before we get into that, normal housekeeping stuff, give us a comment. Give us a rating. Do that on iTunes. It helps people discover the show. Tell your friends about the show. We're awesome. You like us. That's why you're listening. Also, email us podcast@thefilmstageshow and follow us on Twitter @filmstageshow and Facebook. Just search for The Film Stage Show. This was one of two comedies that came out this weekend. Did anyone get a chance to go see Neighbors 2 Sorority Rising?
Not yet.
Well, I read a Film Stage, or no, not Film Stage, Film School Rejects article that was talking about the similarities between the two films in terms of they're about like daddy-daughter relationships.
Hmm.
Okay.
Which, I don't know. I
but
guess
you
I
didn't
could...
see the movie.
No.
Well, that was the question I asked, wasn't it?
No, but I'm just saying.
You're just saying you didn't see the movie.
No, but I thought it was an interesting, that you know, two
comedies. I've heard really good things about Neighbors 2 Sorority Rising.
I'm
so
actually
I
shocked
to talk
because
about that too.
It's weird because I've read reviews that basically just slam the crap out of it, and then I've read glowing reviews.
I have heard awful, awful film. I've also heard best comedy sequel ever and super progressive. So I don't know what to think.
I know,
so
neither
I really want to see it.
Yep, can't wait to watch it.
Yeah, so expect that to come from us.
And I heard
Efron
is like a pure highlight in the film.
Well, he was a highlight of the first film.
I thought it was Rose Byrne that stole the show.
Mm.
Well, yeah, I mean, she was great in it too, but that doesn't mean that Efron couldn't also be it.
Yeah. Yeah, she's a great comedic actress, just
she is.
In general.
I just love Rose Byrne. She's great.
Oh, yeah. She's a delight.
Did y'all see Spy?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
With that hair? Oh, my God. Oh, my God, that hair.
That was some crazy-ass hair. All right, well, unfortunately, none of us got out to see Neighbors 2 Sorority Rising, which is sad, because I've, again, heard some polarizing stuff, and when I hear that, I need to get out there and check it out. So
yeah.
Expect us to check back in. In the meantime, I think the Film Stage gave it a glowing review.
Yeah, we definitely, I think we were one of the ones that said best sequel, comedy sequel
ever.
Of all time.
I know that Benevolent Master, Lord and Master, sorry, Jordan Raup.
Don't get his name wrong.
I know, because he'll hurt me. So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it. But let's talk about a movie we actually saw.
What? Which was that?
The Nice Guys, hopefully.
Oh.
Bill,
oh,
did you see that?
I thought you were talking about The Witch. Oh, never mind.
Oh, we could talk about The Witch some more. The Witch is now out on Blu-ray.
Yep.
Can I just say...
We released it into theaters like 2-3 weeks ago.
So we're actually
like
talking about The Witch now.
Can I just mention real quick? So I had my sleep was very restless last night, and it was because I was having a dream where we were doing a podcast about a Riff Trax version of a movie.
Okay, yeah. I mean, and I woke up and I was like, do, like a Master Pancake review. That'd be hilarious.
No.
It'd be so funny.
But I woke up and I was, you know how you wake up and you're still half asleep and you actually believe that your dream is still happening? And yes. I woke up and I was stressing out because I realized I hadn't seen this Riff Tracks episode.
And you realizing that... Because I had a dream that one of the Skags from the video game Borderlands had eaten my dog. And
oh,
I had
God.
To cut her out of its stomach. And I had just given my dog, both of my dogs, my wife and I got them baths the night before. And they look miserable when they're wet.
They
like,
do.
They're not happy about anything. And that's just like the amount of damage that Lana, my husky, had on her. Was just like wet and super uncomfortable and just like hopped out of this dead thing's stomach and was like, fuck you, and then walked away. What are we talking about? Let's talk about The Nice Guys. The newest film by writer-director Shane Black. Again, starring Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling, along with a number of other actors that you will recognize, including Margaret Qualley, I believe is how you say her name, from The
Daughter
Leftovers.
Daughter of Andy McDowell.
Yeah. We also got Keith David from The Thing. I don't know why that's the first one I went to. He was also in a great canceled show called Enlisted, which was wonderful. We got Matt Bomer, who I know people like from stuff, but I don't know where I've seen him.
He was in, I thought he was in the Magic Mike movie.
Oh, he was in Magic Mike.
Yeah.
He was in something else, too, I think. Anyway, and we also have newcomer Angouri Rice.
Mm-hmm.
Who is a child actress who, spoiler for my thoughts on the film, is amazing.
She's really good.
She's fantastic. Anyway, so let's talk about The Nice Guys. Here is the trailer.
Equanimity. Quality of being calm.
Who is it?
Messenger service.
Even tempered.
Mr. March, we're gonna play a game.
I think you have the wrong house.
Called Shut Up Unless You're Me.
I love that game.
You're a private investigator?
Just 20 bucks in there, all right? Just take it.
No, not here for that. I'm a messenger. Give me your left arm.
No!
Yeah, come on.
No.
When you're talking to your doctor,
no.
You tell him you have a spiral fracture.
No!
Deep breath. I'm not in the
All right, movie. So that is the trailer for The Nice Guys.
I was trying so hard not to laugh.
I gave up that.
Yeah, I was about to say, I almost just let that whole trailer run because I want to see this movie again so badly. And I'm down to just watch the trailer. Again, spoiler alert for my thoughts on the film. So, out in theaters now, wide release. Let's talk about it. Bill Graham, what were your thoughts on The Nice Guys?
Ooh.
I guess, wait, before we go in, let me do... I keep forgetting to do a quick plot rundown. Of these
okay.
things?
Yep.
Of these super, things, these movies?
Super unprofessional on my part. So the plot of this is that Ryan Gosling is a private detective who is trying to find a...
Give me names, please.
Holland March.
Okay, cool.
Great name. Great private detective name. So Holland March is trying to find a missing woman called Amelia. And the reason is because a woman believes that she has seen her dead daughter and he thinks Amelia might have some information.
Dead niece.
Meanwhile, Amelia... Yes, niece. Meanwhile, Amelia has hired Russell Crowe's Jackson Healy, who is basically just muscle for hire, to try and get March off of her tail. But when Jackson Healy believes that Amelia might be in trouble, he teams up with Holland March and his plucky daughter, Holly March, played by Angouri Rice, to try to unravel the mystery of just exactly what the hell is going on. Classic film noir setup. Takes place in L.A. Great location stuff. Even though I don't believe it was shot in L.A. primarily.
I think it was shot in Georgia.
Yeah, I think it was another Atlanta production.
Yeah.
Atlanta, sitting on the rise in the world of the movies.
Mm-hmm. Until they did that gay rights thing.
It's the 1-2 punch of Triple Nine and Nice Guys. We're not getting into politics here, Bill. What did you think of this movie?
I'm just saying.
Bless your heart, Bill.
It got pulled into the movie making business, but anyways.
Yeah.
This film is really interesting because it tries to play this dramatic tone that I think works and then doesn't work. Works and then doesn't work. It has these ups and downs where you're not quite sure if this is just a straight comedy, if you should laugh throughout the film. And I'm trying to think what other Shane Black films kind of ride this line, and I can't really recall any that are this specifically
out. Kiss, and, Kiss, Bang, Bang.
Well, yeah. But like outright funny, and Kiss, then Kiss, Bang, Bang. Simultaneously super dramatic. And I haven't seen Kiss, Kiss, Bang, Bang in probably 6-7 years. So it's been a little while. But this film rides this weird line of being very dramatic for 30 minutes, and then all of a sudden you have a dream sequence or a hallucination sequence, and you're like, what is this? I don't understand what's going on in this film. And it both works and doesn't work, like I said, at certain moments. Sometimes it lands, it's perfect. It works really, really well. And then other times you're just not quite sure what's going on. There's a shootout. There's this big shootout towards the middle of the film that it just goes on for 5, 6, 7 minutes, and you're not quite sure how to feel about the dramatic stakes of the situation, because it doesn't really allow you to have this feel like anything bad is going to happen. Because it's just playing everything so for laughs in this really dramatic like shootout moment, and it was really kind of unwieldy for me at times. Now reflecting back on it, it is absolutely hilarious. I really love the way that they intertwine the different personalities. They keep bringing things back up. Whether it's Ryan Gosling just being an outright drunk throughout the entire film, which is just hilarious, and also you just worry about the guy just, you know, keeping it together. And then Russell Crowe, who, you know, you look at the two of them, and if you know kind of the history behind the actual personalities of these people, Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe, you would think the situation would be flipped. You would think Russell Crowe is the drunk and Gosling is the one that's kind of the straight man. But it's actually, you know, it's fun that Shane kind of understands that mentality and is flipping it. So, you know, it's Russell Crowe being the hard ass and being the guy that's like, keep your shit together. And
who would have ever thought you could cast Russell Crowe as a hard ass?
But yeah, it's funny because the way that they intertwine the daughter as well, Gosling's daughter, is really, really sweet. I enjoyed it, but it's interesting to see how often she kind of saves their asses, and yet Gosling continues to just kind of shoo her to the wayside throughout the film. I'm trying to think what else. The music is great. The set pieces are really enjoyable. The comedic timing, Gosling keeps screeching, and it is hilarious because you just, you know, you don't get to see that from Gosling very often. He plays a very serious character pretty much throughout his career and things like that. And this one, he's really kind of allowed to let loose. He's got a scene in the bathroom stall I don't know how anybody kept a straight face on set or Russell Crowe. I can't imagine that they actually shot the two of them.
I don't think you
them.
Even saw his face.
I'm pretty sure that was like a two shot where they just shot Russell Crowe doing his thing, and then Ryan Gosling, you know, probably cleared out the set, and we're like, okay, nobody can be in here because this is going to get crazy. I'm trying to think because there's so much that happens, and without giving away too much, the plot intertwines this idea of environmentalism throughout that I think a couple of people have picked up on. And, you know, it was funny because I had read that kind of note review that it's kind of an environmentalist film. And yet for the first hour and a half of the film, I was like, where is that plot? And then all of a sudden it shows up and you're like, oh, Okay. There it is. It's definitely not hidden. If you're wondering, like, where is that plot? No, it's definitely running throughout the film underneath, and then the final 30 minutes or so, it's definitely smacks you in the head. I think that's probably one of the things that kind of bugs me the most about the film, is I feel like it's really, really heavy-handed, and I almost feel like the caper that they're working on would be more fun if that wasn't actually involved. We can get into that a little bit later in spoilers and such, but overall, I think the film is hilarious. I'd say 90% of it works for me, and some of it kind of falls flat or feels really weird or out of touch. It's also an oddly long film that, not in runtime, but in just the way it feels, there's several. This is one of those classic movies where you think it can end five different times, and you're like, "Whoa, oh, this is still going." Oh, and then you know,
I don't know that I agree with that.
Well, we can get into that.
Yeah,
so,
we can get into that.
I think Gosling is great. I'm not sure there's a lot for Crow to really be doing, except when he interacts with the daughter. That's his key scenes, is when he interacts with the daughter, and their kind of bond and relationship is kind of the heart of the film to me, more than even Gosling's. And yeah, love the music, you know, late 70s, and they bring out the hits.
All right, Amanda Waltz, yeah. What did you think?
I can kind of see where Bill is going with the film seeming weirdly dramatic. I don't necessarily agree with it. I think this is a very straightforward comedy. But, I mean, this film is emulating a certain era of filmmaking that in itself was emulating a certain era of filmmaking, being 1940s detective films. But if you watch a lot of, because this is set in the late 1970s.
Yeah, 77.
Yeah, and we actually have a list on the film stage right now that I think Tony Hines put together of, I think there's like Dirty Harry and Freebie and the Bean, and which I've watched quite a few detective films from that era. And I will say they are a bit meandering at times, which I would say that this film is too. I feel like it almost emulates that era to a fault. It does not at all diminish my enjoyment of this film. I actually, after I saw it, I thought that I wasn't really going to have a lot to say about it beyond this was a pleasant, fun film. Kind of like when we did What We Do in the Shadows. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot to say about that movie beyond that. But actually, the more I thought about it, the more I realized just how it sort of plays on the 1970s detective formula, where it's sort of, and one of the things it does, I actually thought of Get Carter when I was watching this film, which technically isn't a detective film because it's Michael Caine who's this sort of, he's a criminal who is investigating the death of his, I think, 16-year-old niece. I might be wrong, but you guys have seen The Trip, right?
Wait, The Trip?
No, I have not seen The Trip. I've seen Get Carter.
Yeah.
I've seen Get Carter. I've seen the Mel Gibson version.
Oh, no.
I've seen the Michael Caine version.
Yeah, and I think it reminded me of, I think maybe just because it's so focused around not just the idea of trying to find this young woman, but there's also the porno aspect of it. And well, the reason I was brought in The Trip was because I'm pretty sure the line, like, she was 16 years old, for anybody who's ever seen The Trip, comes from Get Carter. I could be wrong though, it's like Get Carter and a lot of films, like I brought up Dirty Harry earlier. It's this idea of like these macho dudes trying to restore this old order of like tough guys protecting like the women and children from like hippies and just like general scum. And Whereas, like, and they fail, a lot of times they fail to do it because either they just, like, didn't get there in time or because the bureaucracy prevents them mm-hmm. from doing their jobs. Dirty Harry being a very good example of that. And actually, there was a couple scenes in this movie that recalled Dirty Harry. There's a scene where someone dies, a woman dies, and the way that it was shot reminded me a lot of the scene in Dirty Harry where they pull the woman out of the bay, which I'm sure was completely intentional. But in this movie, it's not because, like, they sort of, like, fail, not because of the bureaucracy or just because, like, they didn't get there in time, but because they're completely incompetent. Like, Ryan Gosling is a mess in this movie. And, you know, he just, like, when he gets drunk, it's almost like reverse Popeye,
mm-hmm.
where he just becomes, like, a blithering idiot.
Yeah, he gets blackout drunk within, like,
Within two minutes. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. Like, unless he is. Okay.
Well, he's always got a little bit of a buzz on.
I mean, the house where he and his daughter live is just littered with, like, old Budweiser bottles. And
no, he's one of those guys who is drunk to function and then, like, in two or three drinks tips over into, oops, I've done too much.
Yeah. I mean, it is crazy. Like, the amount of physical comedy he brings to this movie. But, like, anyway, just to finish my point, it's like, whereas, like, so they're completely incompetent, whereas, like, the women are very capable. I mean, Amelia, who's, like, played by Margaret Qualley, she knows exactly what she's doing. She has an agenda. And we can get into this later because this plays into the plot Bill was talking about earlier. And then you have Holly March, who is incredibly smart and savvy. And it's just very interesting the way they sort of, like, flip that. And it's not necessarily, like, I think it's not necessarily, like, trying to say anything too, I mean, it's up front, but sorry. I mean, it's definitely, like, up front, but I think it doesn't, like, you still like Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe's characters just because they are trying very hard. But I mean, it's just the idea that, like, Gosling is so prone to vice and Russell Crowe is basically just, like, babysitting him almost the entire time.
Yep.
Like, there's so many points where, like Gosling will do something. Like, there's this amazing scene at the party where he's playing around with this woman who's dressed as an Indian, and he's like, shoot me. And she pretends to shoot him, and then he's backing up and backing up, and then flips himself over the edge of this building and then just tumbles. Like, he tumbles down the hill. And it is incredible. Like, Ryan Gosling, I really think he's completely underused as a comedic actor. And
Would this compare to Leo in it was just so over the top in the way that they used his comedic timing and also his physical comedy, like his just outright willingness to just go for it, you know?
Yeah, and I think, well, the thing with Gosling, though, is I've always found him to be quite funny in movies.
Yeah.
Like, even in Drive, there are moments where I'm laughing at him because he has this deadpan quality. Yeah. And even at, like, Lars and the Real Girl, too, is a good example, where he's just so deadpan and he's just so naturally funny. Like, even when he's trying not, like, when he's not going for it, like, it's still, there's still a little glimpse of, like, like, comedian in there. And I think that he is doing such a service to this role and to this movie. And there is some, like, Abbott and Costello, like, just straight up old school comedy hijinks in this. Like, he finds a body and Russell Crowe's yelling for him. And he does that Abbott and Costello thing where he's just like, like, he can't, like, it's like he saw a ghost
type of thing. Like,
And it is incredible. And I'm like, I cannot believe they're pulling this off because it is so old school and so ridiculous. And it just works so well. And, you know, and I will say, you know, what Bill was saying about the more sort of like environmentalist aspect of the movie, you know, and I think that that also plays into the comedy, but more in like a winking way, just because of the time period and what we know now about, you know, a lot of, because there's something that having to do with the auto industry in Detroit in this movie. And, you know, I'm sure you can kind of like, without us even talking about it, kind of get like what we're going at. But
yeah,
it's, I really enjoyed this movie. I will admit that there were, and like I said before, I think it emulates that certain era of like 1970s, like detective movies, or even just like kind of like action. I don't even know what to say, like dark noir to a fault, just because it is even emulating like the pacing. But at the same time, like I said, it doesn't like diminish my enjoyment of it. Russell Crowe and Gosling are just great together. I'm glad Crowe has embraced his like slobby middle age spread.
Yeah, it seems like he put weight on for this.
I think.
I don't know.
Did he?
I don't know. What did he look like in The Water Diviner?
Who saw
Brian?
That?
Brian, nobody saw. Well, because like,
I'm pretty sure in The Water Diviner he was more trim.
Well, he's just one of those guys that. It's kind of like Jon Favreau, where like Jon Favreau tried for years to like stay fit, and then one day was like, you know what? I'm a fat dude.
Yeah,
I'm a fat man.
My dad's always my dad's always had this hilarious comment about Russell Crowe being the gladiator, right? And
yeah,
he was like, Russell Crowe is not a guy that you just look at even in the face, like just look at him and you're like, yeah, that dude's a gladiator. No, like that's not like,
well, because he's like, he just looks like the guy who was like a football player and like really super fit in high school, and then after high school, you know, that fat or that muscle kind of like turned to fat a little bit, and he just could never like figure out.
I really have no idea what you people are talking about. Russell Crowe is a physically imposing man.
He's
with
physically
a face
imposing,
built for violence. Like, what are you?
He's physically imposing.
What is even happening on my podcast right now?
But he's like, but he's physically imposing, but he's not like a super fit dude.
He's
never
jacked
really
going
have
to the gym
been.
Guy. He looks like he
no,
worked
he's not.
In a steel mill, and he's got like real. Like
that's the second steel mill reference you've made
today.
No, because you also did it in High Rise.
Oh, okay. Well,
I think you called Luke Evans like a steel mill worker.
Yeah, I did. I guess that's like the manliest profession I can think of. Or
well,
maybe
like,
it's
but
the
I
fact
think
that I watched what was that movie? X-Men Apocalypse, and there was a steel mill in that.
Oh, was
yes,
there
was.
Really?
Yeah, there's a steel mill in that movie.
Good old Fassy works there.
Yeah. Mikey Fass works in a steel mill for a bit in that movie. Mikey Fass, you heard
well,
me.
Well, no, but like I remember when that Robin Hood movie came out with Russell Crowe, and one of the biggest criticisms about that movie was that Russell Crowe just looked really paunchy in it, and they just didn't buy him as this
don't
hero.
Remember that as a criticism for that
oh,
movie.
I do. Well, it's also not a great movie.
I remember that for The Hunger Games, when people said that Jennifer Lawrence looked too big to be starving.
God, oh, that's so disgusting.
Well, yeah. I mean,
but nobody looked starving.
No, that's the problem. I think that was a major problem with most people's conception of that movie. It's called The Hunger Games.
Yeah.
No one looks particularly malnourished.
No.
Well, it's awfully hard to be malnourished and be in The Hunger Games, right? So.
But I mean, there's The Hunger Games.
Well,
this
Christian
is the problem
Bale
with never having
genius.
Read the book and just trying to understand it from the title.
Yes.
I have no interest in reading.
Many of those kids seemed quite wealthy.
Well, some of them were.
Well, one of them was the bread boy. So.
Well, no, like some of them,
no,
the closer to the district, the closer
like
to the capital,
one,
the
like
more well
guys,
off you
they
are.
They weren't hungry.
We're talking about the hungry.
Anyways, no.
Russell Crowe. I just want to, like, I guess blunt some of the weird criticisms that he's getting, because...
No, I'm not criticizing it. I'm just saying that, like, he is not an actor who has been known to be, like, a super... He's not, like, a Chris Evans. Like, Chris Evans, a lot of his...
But see, that's the
star power comes from being super
fit. This is one of the weird things. Like, if you look at like John McClane in the first Die Hard, like that was fit at the time because he was just a regular guy. And now it's like with, I don't know, these people doing P90X and steroids and shit. It's like
the biggest,
our conception of fit now is like you have to look like Venice Beach.
Well, it's like Sporno. Have you heard of Sporno?
Wait, can we examine what Sporno means?
Sporno is, I don't even know if it's a big thing, but it's basically like think of Brad Pitt and Fight Club.
Okay.
It's super fit, but also sort of like drawn looking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like, it's like an edgy fit. Yeah.
So like a ripped guy who hasn't had any water in 3 days?
No, kind of, just like a skinny ripped dude. Skinny ripped dude.
It's kind of a new term that emerged recently.
That's a terrible term.
Yeah. It's a really awful term.
I think all this kind of started around the time when the superhero films kind of started to get big. You know, you look at the X-Men, you look at Spider-Man. What was like one of the first big scenes you see in Spider-Man is when he wakes up and he flexes in the mirror, right?
Right.
And he's like, whoa, I got abs. And you're like, whoa, Tobey Maguire, puffy Tobey Maguire got a little jack. Cool.
Yeah, and then this is spurred on by 300.
Exactly. Yeah.
But
and
see,
then 300
like,
all of a sudden lands, and then every
no, but I'm
Marvel
saying it's a good thing.
This point, from this point on, has had a scene where they specifically give you beefcake, where they're like, hey, don't remember Paul Rudd, who used to just be, you know, just kind of thin and mushy? Well, look at this. He's got abs now.
I'm just going to make a ruling. We're never allowed to say beefcake on this podcast again.
Okay.
You know I'm going to say it all the time now, Brian.
Fine. Well, I'm gonna talk about cheesecake. Well, I mean, how do you like that?
It's cheesecake?
Cheesecake.
Brian just can't
stay away
from the
food. You know what cheesecake
is,
right? No, cheesecake
is a real thing.
Cheesecake
porn? Like, what do you...
Can't stay away from the food.
Cheesecake. It's those, like, you know, like the pinup girls who were, like, drawn on the side of World War II bombers? That's cheesecake.
Yeah. Why would that bother me?
I don't know. I just, like, we're going to start talking about people like cakes.
I like cheesecake.
We might as well just have some cake terminology.
Well, no, but what I'm saying is I'm not talking about Crow's body in like a negative way. I think it's good that we have that he looks the way he does, because if he was fit in this movie, it wouldn't make any sense.
Right.
Because like you said, he's a very imposing figure. He's also a very sad man.
Yeah. And we find out why in a hilarious flashback.
Oh, my God. Because that's the thing. Like, as much as we talk about Gosling having his like. Gosling obviously provides, like, I would say the majority of, like, the comedic talent in this movie, but Crow has some good moments, too. Like, I think he does a spit take in that flashback.
Yes, he does. Yes. It is the best spit take on Earth.
Yeah. But, like, and I'm not saying...
And he, like, cleans her up, too.
Yeah.
He's like, are you okay? Are you okay? You're just what? No, that's not the reaction there.
Sorry, I did not realize that me talking about Crow's physique was going to get this... I wouldn't have said anything if I knew it was going to go on for this long. Jesus. But no, I'm not saying it like as a criticism.
Okay,
move on. Yeah, it's kind of like this whole thing with women where it's like...
Yeah, no, you like Russell Crowe being fat. It's great.
I love it. It's great. He looks wonderful. I want to cuddle him.
He's very sad.
Despite what I've heard about him.
And I think he's gotten better, hasn't he?
I don't know.
I think he's mellowed with age, I would imagine.
Yeah, you know, you see some like the Water Diviner, and you're like, "That's a man who's mellowed down."
God damn it, I hate that title. I hate it so much.
We didn't talk about Money Monster, so we didn't get a chance about the worst titles of any movie ever.
Oh, I know. That's such a because we were going for we had quite a list. Actually,
we had a massive list. I don't even remember most of what was on it. but yeah, I thought that Russell Crowe in this movie was fantastic. Everyone keeps talking about Gosling. You know what? We've known for a while that guy is great. I think we all forgot that Russell Crowe is also great. So I'm glad that he had a chance to do this and really flex his comedic chops. Because a lot of what he does in this movie is like a hilarious take on his character from L.A. Confidential.
Mm. Can we break in real quick? Because
I am finally getting to give my opinion and you want to break in?
Well, you're like... two sentences into your opinion. Is this the first Shane Black movie not set in Christmas?
There's Christmas at the end.
It's like very end. Yeah, there's Christmas.
There's some Christmas.
Damn it.
There's some Christmas in there.
Yeah.
I don't know what that has to do with anything, but
well, it is he does have like a fixation on Christmas. Yes,
yeah, like pretty much all of his films revolve in and around.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, except for Monster Squad, which apparently he wrote, which blew my mind.
I heard that, and it was crazy to me.
He must have been like 10 years old when he wrote that.
Yeah,
he wrote that. He's not that old.
He wrote that before he found out Santa Claus wasn't real.
Christmas has a lot of meanings for Shane Black.
Yeah. Oh,
anyway,
it's in Iron Man 3. Yeah, it's like it runs throughout. Yeah, it runs throughout his film kind of au revoir. Is that, did I say that right?
I think it's oeuvre.
Oeuvre. Okay.
That, what is that, a Ninja Turtle?
Oeuvre, bruh. Anyway. Why'd you say that like you were pushing your glasses back up into your nose? Like,
oeuvre.
Because you can't say oeuvre without pushing your glasses up your nose. I don't even wear glasses, and glasses appear slightly further down on the bridge of my nose than I'm comfortable with as I say oeuvre, just so I can push them up. Anyway, so I really like this movie. I don't have any problems with the tone. I don't think it drags. I think that it's a nonstop riot of action and comedy from front to back. I think the characters are well drawn. And I think that their various journeys throughout the film are at once unexpected and deeply cathartic. And I loved it. See how easy that is?
That was it?
Wow.
I don't know. I could talk
about... But what did you think about the physique
Gosling's
of
mustache.
All of the... Go into detail about Russell Crowe's body for me, please.
You know, he's got a bit of a punch.
I'm just joking. We could balance it out by talking about Misty Mountains.
Can I just say, I love the part, speaking of, I love the part where he walks, it's when he first goes in and assaults Holland. Jackson leaves and he takes an apple with him, and then Holly walks up and she's like, "Do you want a yoo-hoo?" And he's like, "A yoo-hoo," and he just like throws
the apple away. And then later on, he's got like a whole crate of yoo-hoo.
I noticed that, and I was wondering, so like, I thought he was going to deliver it somewhere, and then
no,
I was
he
like,
got that for himself, bro.
Yeah, I know.
Because he's a sad fat man.
Yeah, he's a guy who just doesn't give a shit anymore, and he's like, "I'll take an apple. I could eat an apple." And then someone's like, "A yoo-hoo," and he doesn't even think like, "I could have this yoo-hoo and eat this apple." He's like, "Fuck this apple."
And have you ever had yoo-hoo?
I love yoo-hoo.
Oh, it's disgusting.
You go to hell, Amanda.
Oh, it tastes like
chocolate
flavored.
You go to hell and you die. What are you talking about? Yoo-hoo is the best.
It tastes like chocolate flavored bull semen. It's disgusting.
First of all, I know you grew up on a farm. Do you know what bull semen tastes like?
Legit question.
This is a real question, because if I said it as a man of the urban and suburban stripe, people would be like, "Oh, he's being hyperbolic,"
or
that's
that
one
he
of those
has
weird things
like
that
erectile
do.
Dysfunction.
I just snorted like really loudly.
Well, it's fine. It's anyway, I love Yoo-hoo. I love this movie. Here, this is
so gross.
This can help me out. I am currently sitting amongst my like a part of my collection of books, and I have numerous noir fiction on my shelves.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from L.A. Confidential by James Ellroy and other Ellroy novels to things by Dashiell Hammett, and like we're talking about like Maltese Falcon, Thin Man, the collected works of Raymond Chandler, whose famous Philip Marlowe is perhaps my favorite private detective, and I love how this movie makes it its business to kind of send up some of those tropes while also perfectly working within the framework that they have put up. It's great. It's something that he did similarly in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. And if this is the only type of movie he ever makes, I'm totally fine with that, because...
Yeah, and I honestly think this is an improvement from Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
I have to watch Kiss Kiss Bang Bang again, but yeah. I think this is a more fully formed movie. I think that the lack of Robert Downey Jr. metatextually interacting with the narrative helps just to be a little more straight. But I don't know. Val Kilmer as Gay Perry was great. He's an indelible character.
R.I.P. Val Kilmer. I know he's not really dead, but I mean, we all know.
Oh,
he was in that Francis Ford Coppola Vampire movie.
Valley Baby.
No, do not even bring up Twixt.
Good old Valley Baby.
So bad.
Iceman. We liked him because he was dangerous. Anyway, so what I will say is that this is more of a movie, whereas Kiss Kiss Bang Bang felt like a statement of purpose and a guy who had something to prove, and he proved it. And so this time he's doing it straight, and it works. It works super well. I think that there's a payoff to a dream sequence in this movie that is just like, I don't think I've ever seen anything like it in a movie before. And it is incredible and amazing and hilarious and a perfect character beat. And yeah, I like, that's the type of thing that this movie gives you and gives you in spades. And so anyone who goes and sees this and is disappointed is probably not someone that I wish to associate with on a social level.
Yeah, I honestly can't see how you could be disappointed with this movie. It is just, like you said, like nonstop hilarity. It is just out to please. It just wants to please you and make you laugh. And that's it.
Yeah, and it does it.
Yeah.
All right.
So that's spoiler time.
Yeah, I was about to say that's our review. we all seem to like it. We all seem to think that you all should go see it. So let's dive into the spoilers so that we can talk about some plot. We're gonna not untangle the entire thing, but it'll just give us the opportunity to talk about perhaps some more scenes that we like and the broader themes of the film. So spoilers. For the nice guys. So just to kick it out, the entire plot of this movie is predicated on a porno that was made that was going to be a means for a bunch of environmental activists to get the word out about how catalytic converters could help save LA from the smog issue that's plaguing it. But powerful Detroit businessmen are actually having the people who created that killed in order to help bolster their profits and keep that information suppressed. It ends with a hilarious monologue by Kim Basinger, who says...
Yes, Kim Basinger's in this... Basinger? Oh, well.
I think Basinger.
Is in this movie. Again, she, LA Confidential.
Yeah, it's great. And she has a speech where, like, they've won, but they haven't really won in classic noir detective standard? Anyway. And she says... Like, America's nothing without the big three. No matter what happens, you'll never take down Detroit. And she says it, like, right into the camera to all of us living on the other side of the 20th century who know that it's not true. And it's amazing. And
wait, what?
What?
Detroit is still
Detroit's
very much
in ruins.
Detroit is the all of Detroit, like, went bankrupt. Like, entirety
there
of
is
Detroit.
No Detroit.
Detroit
anymore.
Is, but the big three are still very much alive and viable.
No.
Oh,
Ford is fucking kicking
Bill,
ass. GM got bailed out, but like GM's still alive and kicking. And then, of course, you have Fiat that bought Daimler Chrysler, which now is still doing fairly well. Like, the auto industry is not in crisis anymore.
It's not gone. It hasn't, like, disappeared, but it's not.
The reason Detroit died is because they shipped most of the manufacturing out of the state.
Yeah, but again,
but
those
Detroit
cars
was synonymous
are not selling
with
as
the
well
auto
as
industry.
They used to.
Yeah,
and as important as those industries were to America, they died. They ruined lives. They took out an entire major metropolitan area with them and are only now slightly coming back. And it's, again, not because of the petrochemical industries, but because of things like hybridization of cars.
Right.
You cannot, Bill, tell me that that speech isn't meant to be a thumb in the eye of auto corporations who grew bigger and bigger and eventually crashed because of the fact that they were pumping out gas-guzzling monstrosities while the rest of the world was slowly coming to understand that you could not and should not continue to operate that in a way.
Yeah, and yet...
Let's go throw some eggs at some Hummers.
The truck is one of the best-selling vehicles still on the market. And that thing just doesn't... It's basically
foolproof. Yeah, but you have to think in, like, the 1970s...
The late 70s.
Cars were getting, like, no mileage to the gallon.
Sure, I understand. Yeah. I understand what y'all are getting at, but I'm still saying the automaker industry is still very much alive and pertinent to this day. And
well, Bill, let's go to Detroit, and let's ask some people about that.
That's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about
I'm not
their
saying that cars are no longer
Detroit.
A thing.
But this film kind of...
Well, I just get around by horse-drawn carriage now.
Well, you live on a farm.
Oh, well, yeah, definitely.
Also,
that's how I've gotten around.
Apocalyptic wasteland of Pittsburgh.
it's also, it's not, to me, I didn't read it just as them pointing the finger at the auto industry. I saw them pointing the finger at both the banking industry, at both, just, I mean, you can build it up. You can point it at Walmart. You can point it at the Targets. You can point it at all sorts of different corporations where they've gone upward, where they've just conglomerated to each other. And I think that's kind of what this film is really hinting at and pointing at, is that no, it's not just 1977 automakers. It's today. It's what kind of policies and regulations are put into place? Who are the immovable objects that we can literally find huge amounts of faults with and yet can't get rid of? That's what this film is really kind of pointing at. And that's why it's so pertinent to today, because it's pointing at us and saying, hey, yes, I understand the automakers are still around, but guess what? They're still leading the charge in a lot of ways. And we also have big banks. We also have, you know, big corporations like the Walmarts and things like that, where it's just like, okay, who's running this ship? And is it the government that you think is running the ship, or is it a lot of the, you know, what do they call them? The people lobbyists. Yeah, the lobbyists and things like that. And so it becomes kind of frightening, because you realize, okay, this is relevant to 1977, but it's also relevant to today.
No, it definitely is. Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, it's an entire plot based upon an environmental concern that a powerful industry wish would go away.
There's also the bees.
Oh, yep, the bees. There's the bees.
Which is
and the birds. We're dead.
Poor bees.
We died because of the smog. The gas mask didn't help.
can we talk about Amelia in the penthouse, where they are going up the— this is one of the things that really kind of confused me throughout the film, because it's Russell Crowe that really is kind of this guy that has the heart of gold, right? And he's kind of the guy that kind of leads the charge, and really once he realizes there is something up, he's the one that turns around and goes back to go get Gosling, right? And he wants to get him involved because he realizes, hey, he had a lead. Let's go track down that lead. Let's go figure out where this woman is. And they get up to the penthouse and see shit going bad, and they just fucking leave? What?
Because
are you kidding me?
Okay, well, the fact that there is a killer there who's murdering people, the gunfight already seems to have been lost.
The eunuchs are dying.
The Munichs.
The Munichs.
The Munichs.
No, I mean, like, there is a difference between being the type of guy who says we should go up there and help to going into a slaughterhouse and saying, okay, maybe we should let the police handle this. Because when they leave, the police are on their way.
Well, the other thing, too, is that...
like, I had no trouble with that.
Going back to Bill's point about how, like, Crow's the one who's always like, we should go back. Gosling is like a scared little rabbit.
Yeah, well, his
tendency to flinch
of
in this
is
movie.
Super old people.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it seems to pretty much be ladies that literally look out of Coke bottles. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. Lois Smith is so funny in this movie. But yeah, like the amount of flinching that he does in this movie is just everything. Like there's a part where they're at a child's birthday party. It's one of his daughter's friends at a bowling alley. And his daughter just walks up and says hi, and he flinches and looks at her. And he's just I don't know if it's because like he's been had the crap beaten out of him or— and there's an amazing part where it's where Matt Bomer's character, who plays a guy named John Boy, who is a hitman, I'm guessing.
A hitman who will throw a, like, 11-year-old girl out of a window.
I will say, okay, that brings up another point. That's something that I love about movies that I think is completely missing, that I love so much from movies from the 1970s, is people jumping or getting thrown from through plate glass windows. This movie had that in spades, and I fucking loved it.
Like when Gosling cuts his arm open?
Oh my god!
That is one of the best scenes
after
in the entire
movie.
After
taking so much care to wrap up his hand, he puts a fist through a window and ends up cutting his arm open. And he's like, ooh, that's a lot of blood. And then it smash cuts to an ambulance.
Oh my
god. And the people saying, we're losing him.
Because he's like hitting a major artery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my.
And he can't be around blood or like general grossness, and like he almost throws up. And so he looks down at his arm and he's like, "Oh, that's a lot of blood." And then you hear him like dry heave and you're like, "Oh no."
Oh, where they found Shattuck's body? Oh god. Yeah. Hat rack. I will say that kid who plays that kid on the bike that they interview. Who is that kid?
I don't know, but
he is amazing.
He needs to be in more stuff.
He's like a 10-year-old kid who brags about having a big dick. It was amazing. And that's another through runner of this movie is the concept of like children growing up too fast and like the abandonment of old morals, which is it's something that never fails in any form of art. I mean, I like detective fiction in the same way I like Westerns, because it's a genre that can be transplanted pretty much anywhere, because it doesn't just need to be in LA to be a detective story, but you can have that kind of like groovy, seedy underside cool to it and still work it out. As was proven in Brick, when they basically took that and applied it to high school.
Yeah.
And like old school Westerns. I mean, like Assault on Precinct 13 is pretty much a Western. But it takes place in an inner city. It's just that concept of like, who are the main characters? What are the story beats we're going to hit?
Well, it is funny because I think this film likes to build people up and then simultaneously tear them down. One of my favorite sequences is when Russell Crowe is about to leave, because he's realized Ryan Gosling is just a drunk, barely functioning detective. And he's about to leave him, and Gosling is like, "Hey, by the way, that's not an airport." He gets this tip off of this clothing or out of a film case. And Gosling takes like one look at it and I guess kind of interprets it one way, and of course Russell Crowe interprets it the way that it's actually written. And Gosling's like, "Hey, I got a hot tip, by the way. That's not an airport, like, you know, what is it, boarding
like
gate or something? Yeah, like a schedule.
Yeah, it's not flight. It's flat. It's, you know, it's
yeah."
He mentions early on in the film that his wife was British, and I think it's like, "Oh, I have like knowledge that you don't have." Where it's like, "No, you're full
and
of shit."
He's got this like great like line and it builds up, and then all of a sudden you're like, "Oh, Gosling's got his shit together. Cool." And then all of a sudden they come to this flat that's a fucking construction site that's just demolished, and you're like, "Oh, shit."
I know.
and of course, what does Gosling say? He's like, "I guess we're going to the airport." And they're like, "Oh, okay." And of course, the way that they pay that off is that they don't actually end up going to the airport. They end up going to this penthouse, like right down the road from it, which turns out to be, I mean, it's both
like the
airport
Westin or something
like
that.
Yeah, I don't know. Hotel. I don't know if Crowe was there, if Gosling wasn't there, if he would have found it regardless. But it's definitely
definitely pointed that out.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those moments where
he was almost there.
He was almost there, and you're like, "Oh, he's finally." No, he doesn't.
So much of this movie is just happenstance. It's just like complete coincidence where it's
like the fact that they get Amelia back. She literally lands on top of their car.
Right.
Well, that's
like they didn't find her.
No, she jumped on their car. What I love is that's a thing about detective fiction. I mean, if you watched The Maltese Falcon, as I did after I saw this movie, you know, Sam Spade doesn't do shit in that movie.
No.
A woman walks in, asks for someone to tail someone that Sam's partner does, and his partner dies. And then the cops come to Sam, and then the woman comes to Sam, and then a completely different guy comes to Sam that's after the same thing the woman is, and he just acts like he knows more than he does. Everyone tells him everything, And then by the end, he's got enough pieces to put everything together.
Right.
And he's basically, well, I mean, and he's so open about the fact that he's betraying people. He's just like, I'm helping you for money. If you give me more money, I'll help you for money. And he ends the movie with like thousands of dollars that people have given him. Even though, spoiler alert for the Maltese Falcon, he does not end up with the Maltese Falcon.
No.
The other thing that kind of wigged me out about this film is there's a through line where Gosling is very attracted to this African-American...
Yaya DaCosta, I think
like
her name is.
Assistant, I guess? I don't know what... She's assistant with like the Bureau or the CIA, whoever Kim Basinger basically works for. And... he's just enamored with her from the moment he sees her, and it just completely blinds him to anything and everything that they do. But it caught me off guard that Russell Crowe's character, who's also very aware of the fact that this guy like can't keep his eyes off of her, lets them get into a situation where they are taking the classic briefcase filled with nothing but like fake bills, and it's not even like fake bills, it's like,
and the way they figured it out is so unorthodox, where he falls asleep while driving, has a dream about
bees,
a bee that is voiced by Hannibal Buress, by the way, and then crashes, and that's how the suitcase flies open. It's not like they discovered it.
Yeah, that was one of the things that really kind of, I was like, this is so obviously, and even, they're even talking amongst themselves before they get the briefcase, talking about the fact that this may be a double cross, and yet continue to just completely go through it, completely blind, and I was...
Because well, doesn't he say something, he's like, she must not have known that these... That these were in here.
Oh, I don't understand. She packed it herself. She must have been swapped out.
He actually mentions that. No, he tells her that.
And then
when
he
sees her later,
that she's killed three people, and he's like, "This isn't you." And Russell Crowe's like, "No, she says that she's done this." He's like, "Yeah, but like deep down."
It's so amazing.
And then,
that
and then of
scene
course,
with
Russell
the bee
Crowe
is amazing.
And then, of course, so Russell Crowe is like, "Well, once you get like the first one is kind of a you know." Maybe, but the second and the third, like by that time, you've already turned that corner. And Gosling's just like incredulous when he looks at him. He's just like, no, this is not true.
And that scene in the projection room is the point where it's because that car ride with Gosling, he sees Russell Crowe like brandishing an ankle piece, and then he drops to the floor in the projection room. And is searching his ankles for the gun. And
he
the
searches them
like,
for like a good 30 seconds.
What are you
seconds.
Doing? And then Russell Crowe's like, I don't know what he's doing. He's like, where's your ankle gun? He's like, I don't have an ankle gun. It's like, oh shit, was that a dream? Speaking of, hey, that ties it back into that bullshit we were talking about earlier about dreams.
Yeah.
That was totally on point.
Yeah.
We are true professionals here.
I meant for that to happen.
My favorite thing about this movie.
Did that briefcase scene not bug anybody else?
No.
Oh, no. I was
didn't
fine
care.
With it. Okay. No, nothing in this movie bugged me. And I will say that, like, and I think we're getting there, but, like, there are two main set pieces in this movie that are really the highlights of just everything. And it is the party scene at Shattuck's amazing house.
Yeah.
Which, if I do not believe in heaven, but
I had to question the mermaids.
That would be my heaven, is basically that party at Shattuck's house. Just like Earth, Wind, and Fire there, like people are playing Earth, Wind, and Fire.
I thought it was really interesting the way that they almost lead you to believe that Earth, Wind, and Fire are actually at the party, but also are like very obviously like showing like concert footage. And I was like, because
no,
first
that's not
I was
concert
like,
footage. That's people playing Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Is it?
Oh, yeah, because it had that kind of like dreamy lighting quality to it.
Yeah,
that looks
I thought it looked like footage. I thought it looked
no. Those are just people playing Earth, Wind, and Fire.
All right,
like okay. It's definitely there, but like
so there was
I,
a live band because you never see the live band interact with like the party.
No,
guys.
I think they were the only ones because you see when he's walking up to the house, like you see somebody drumming, and it's like there is a live band there because they're on the top of that house. So it's definitely Earth, Wind, and Fire are there, but they're just played by people.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But like, and but that is amazing because it's just Russell Crowe's actually investigating, whereas Ryan Gosling is basically just screwing around and getting drunk. And it's, and then the end, the final, just like the final showdown.
At it's the auto like, show.
At the auto show. It's like dominoes falling. Mm-hmm. Just the amount. It's like people falling down and getting up. People falling down and getting up. People falling down and getting up. It's like Ryan Gosling.
The point where Ryan Gosling says, "I don't think I can die." That's the only explanation.
Oh my God. When he falls, when him and Keith David fall off of the building.
He's falling through stuff.
Oh my God. Like he falls and gets up and falls and gets up. And he's just, and in the background, there's all these people getting shot or like blown up.
There's this great moment where he falls into a pool and it calls back this conversation they were having before they got double crossed.
Oh, about Nixon.
And he sees Nixon God, in the pool and he like points at him and he like shakes his head and is like, no, this isn't the way this happens.
And which like, was that story supposed to make sense? The whole Nixon story?
I think it was. It like makes sense if you think about it, but it's definitely like the longest possible way to say.
Yes,
it's super convoluted.
Yeah,
yeah.
And he calls him out for that, which is awesome.
That's the hilarious thing about this film is like Gosling keeps towing that line between like very aware of what's going on, and then also like completely oblivious of what's going on. So I mean, it's hilarious because like. I think there's one moment where he is, it's after the party scene at Sid Shattuck's, and he wrecks a Corvette or a Camaro, I can't remember which one.
Oh my God.
And he drives up after they kill one of the main bad guys, and he's like stone cold sober, and you're like, what?
Yeah,
what?
Well, the funny thing about that too is you think he's gonna hit the I just think of him as Keith David's henchman. I don't know. It's Blueface, I think they call him.
Yeah.
Because he gets that, like, money bag blows up at his face.
Yeah.
And you think that he's going to do this, you know, this amazing car driving choreography and hit this guy. No, he just crashes into a tree. It's so great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's, I think, Brian, you definitely touched on this, just the way it plays with the tropes of. Not just detective films, but just like, you know, like films that play on the tropes of detective films. So it's like doubling down. It's crazy. I mean, it's just like a play on a play.
Like my favorite, and this will probably help me to just wrap up and why I like this movie so much. So Ryan Gosling wakes up after like a drunken stupor in a bathtub filled with water, completely dressed with a ballpoint pen written on his hand that says "You will never be happy," mm-hmm. with a smiley face. And at the end of the movie, the "never" gets smudged off, mm-hmm. so it says "You will be happy," and that's like corny, but he like sees it, and his reaction to it is in the way that like if you were to say something to yourself like "All I need is a dollar," and then a dollar were to like float in front of you on the street. Mm-hmm. You'd be like, okay, I know this is stupid and I shouldn't think that I have powers, but this is still awesome. And then not only that, but the way that the whole movie goes, Russell Crowe keeps denying drinks. Like people offer him a drink and he says no. And then mm-hmm. Ryan Gosling is drinking like a fish. And so you think that the movie's going to end with both of them like saying no to a drink and Ryan Gosling being like, yep, I'm sobering up, buddy. It's going to be fine.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, we find... Russell Crowe getting drunk at a bar, and Ryan Gosling literally comes up to him and says, well, at least you're drinking again.
He's like, I feel great.
Yeah. They're doing great. They have their own detective agency, and the entire, like, redemptive arc of I'm going to give up this addiction that stands in for my sadness has been inverted, because Russell Crowe is now drinking. But, hey, he's got a surrogate family. He's not as lonely as he was. And maybe, just maybe, he'll shape up and lose a couple pounds. Right, Amanda?
I like him the way he is.
Uh-huh.
The other thing that kind of – it was interesting because it all kind of – for me, some of the comedy and drama bits that I found that kind of were unwieldy were surrounding Amelia. And so you know, I mentioned earlier that they have this weird moment, to me at least, where they go up to the penthouse and they see shit is going down and they're just like basically give up. And so, of course, you as an audience at that moment are like, whoa, that's kind of a dark ending for this film to kind of go down. And then, of course, she shows back up on their car. And then they have this big shootout, just extravagant shootout at their house. And you're like, oh, okay. Like this is the moment where they triumphantly like kill the bad guy, or he just decides to leave. And of course, the cops arrive and they have this ridiculously long shootout with him where they literally like chop down a palm tree. You're just like, wow, okay. And you know, Gosling is like screaming his head off throughout this entire film.
That part where the entire sequence.
And so like, it's so it's upping the stakes because you're like, wow, this is really dramatic. And yet Gosling just can't, his character just can't help but be hilarious throughout it. And so you're laughing and like worried about these characters. And then at a certain point, after about 2 minutes of this firefight, you just kind of like, okay, I guess nothing is actually going to happen here. I'm just going to keep laughing. And where the film ends up winding up, like taking it, is Amelia escapes because she's basically like realizes like shit is going down and I got to get out of here. She runs out and then gets shot in the face by the dude that just took off.
So awesome.
And you're like, I don't understand.
That's
whether
not what I was like at all, Bill.
Well, I know. I understand that you don't have an issue with the film. I've said that again and again. Yeah.
Yeah, but you should be saying I.
What? Oh, well, okay. I keep reiterating the fact that this is my opinion, but if I need to reiterate the fact that this is my opinion, this is my opinion that this is how I felt.
Yes.
This is how I felt. I felt like they gave us this dramatic stake of having Amelia throughout the film and being kind of the MacGuffin in a way, almost more than the film itself that they end up kind of replacing as a MacGuffin. There's like two MacGuffins in this film. And they kind of – yeah, because the film is kind of a MacGuffin and then they give up on it because they realize it's done. The porno film.
Yeah.
Because they
think it's been destroyed.
Yeah, so they give up on it.
But they still have Amelia.
Exactly.
But
and then
Amelia's
gone. And then they turn back to the other MacGuffin. It's crazy.
It's awesome.
But they've basically given us Amelia as this kind of character that we're supposed to latch onto and kind of care for. And it's also Kim Basinger's daughter. And there's this conspiracy plot about like trying to kill her. And you're like, you're rooting for her because she keeps escaping and she keeps getting out of these bad situations. And then all of a sudden in the middle, like right after this hilarious firefight, which I said, like, it builds up. Like, if it had ended 2 minutes earlier and stayed dramatic, I would have been kind of fine with it. Even with, like, Gosling kind of screaming his head off, it would have been funny and it would have kind of balanced that. But they just went a little bit too long in that firefight to where it came back on itself and started just becoming funny. And then they kill off this girl that you're like, wait. She was really fucking important in this film. I don't understand where this film is going at all. And that was kind of one of those moments where I felt like I just didn't understand where this film was taking me. And it's both a good thing and a bad thing, right? I mean, so often it's so easy to see where a film is going to go and see, you know, where the plot threads are and things like that and follow it through. But for me, this film almost did it too much to where I was constantly not quite understanding whether I was supposed to be laughing throughout the film or feeling very dramatic about the situations and the stakes, because the stakes are very much real. And that scene in particular puts it in like complete context where you're like, holy shit, this girl just got shot in the face. Like,
yeah.
But again, it's that whole thing. It's the whole coincidental aspect, where even Matt Bomer
says, he just runs into her.
He basically is like, I can't believe how lucky I am. Yeah. Like,
what did they always say in Arrested Development? Like, that's a freebie.
Basically. Yeah. Well, no, and I
loved that about this film. Like,
oh yeah, and
just,
I think it's
everything is just happening, and you kind of are being caught off guard constantly. And so, like, when Amelia got shot in the face, I did a shocked gasp laugh because I was like,
"Yeah, I did too.
God, like what?"
Yeah,
but no, amazing. I think that's the thing about that makes this film work too, is that it's. Yeah, it could have functioned as just purely a goofy comedy.
Well, and
the fact that it had stakes,
that it doesn't do that. I appreciate the fact that it doesn't do that, and there are films that definitely nail that. And I, like I said, like these are small little quibbles with the film, but they're things that caught me off guard to the point where I was like,
"Well, that's good, though."
Yeah, but also it's kind of a criticism because I'm like, this doesn't work flawlessly for me. It doesn't function as well as I would hope it would.
I guess I just don't have an issue.
I don't understand, or it wasn't my feeling.
Did you feel guilty for laughing at it, Bill? Is that why?
No.
just curious. No, I don't know. I had like no problem with anything. I thought that the tone was great, and I loved how like dangerous it felt, just because like you're in the middle of laughing, but at the same time something terrible could happen.
I mean, like, and you said it's just an 11
this heightened level of anything can happen, the unexpectedness of cinema.
Well, you have to think
of a person talking about car emissions in the middle of a porn. It's
and I think too it kind of points out like how conservative I think films have become in a lot of ways, because if you watch, and this kind of goes back to the fact that Shane Black wrote Lethal Weapon and a lot of action comedies that came out in the 80s. But if you watch like a lot of action comedies that come out in the 80s, they are brutal. I mean, it is shocking how much violence. I mean, if you think about, like, I watched Beverly Hills Cop 2 recently, and I was
shocked. What do you mean
shocked
by action comedies?
Well, because if you think about, I'm trying to think of like action comedies now, like what's that movie that's coming out, Central Intelligence?
Well, to me, action comedy,
there's
no way around the fact that that's an action comedy.
It's an action comedy, but what I'm saying,
I understand that, but that's,
I think action comedies are pretty easily defined.
Yeah,
I don't know if I really need to explain what an action comedy is.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying Shane Black's action comedies, because you just mentioned Lethal Weapon, and I don't see that necessarily as a comedy.
Really?
Don't?
No, that's crazy, Bill.
Oh, no, Bill, that's a comedy.
I see that as...
Yeah.
I mean,
I haven't
seen
that
in like 15 years, but...
Yeah, but what I'm saying is I think this is sort of a return to that era in a lot of ways of just... very like shocking violence, but at the same time, like I said, very goofy, like Abbott and Costello era comedy, and just how strange that formula is and how that actually was like the style of a time and how weird that is. Cause I think Pineapple Express also did that too. Cause if you think about like the shootout at the end of that movie where it's just like, oh my God, this is crazy. Yeah. And it like comes out of nowhere. But at the same time, I think this movie, I don't think that it comes out of nowhere in this movie. I think it's integrated very well. But it's just interesting, like, just watching films from the 80s and realizing, like, I watched these as a kid, and these are really bloody and really awful and, like, really kind of...
Even things like Indiana Jones, like, that's... Ugh.
Yeah, and it just made me think of, like, man, how mild... mannered like action comedies are now, and like bloodless in a lot of ways.
Well, the film that kind of is similar to this in that it's balancing those dramatic tones and both comedic tones to me is of course I can't think of it, the recent director that did Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Wes
Anderson?
Yes, his hotel movie.
Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yes, that's...
His hotel movie.
Yeah, you know, when I don't have things kind of on the tip of my tongue and have to go down that rabbit hole, I'm glad I have wonderful co-hosts like y'all that I can just like throw out random things and y'all are like, oh, I know what you're talking about. because to me that film worked about as flawlessly in this kind of genre as I could hope and expect.
Because that's a film where like people get fingers cut off and a head is in a basket.
It's basically one guy that is just terrorizing throughout the entire film, which is just like, if you told me there is this kind of quirky, funny comedy where this Willem Dafoe is terrorizing people throughout the film, you'd be like, how does that even work?
Well, and first of all, it's Willem Dafoe.
Right.
So
but
I expect him to be terrorizing any film he's in.
That's true.
Like, even if he's playing like a love interest, it's like, oh.
Yeah, exactly. I think that film works flawlessly in the way that it balances that comedy and those dramatic stakes because it doesn't stay in either one realm. It's so hard to put your finger on how much, and that's kind of one of those different strokes for different folks kind of things where, you know, some comedies just don't work for people and some comedies work really well for people. And I think all the comedic moments in this film work flawlessly for me. It's some of the dramatic kind of the weight that he places on some of the things I think are just off enough for me to be like, whoa, I don't quite, I'm not quite with it. So it's interesting. It's interesting that y'all don't really have that issue and I do.
No,
I don't know.
It is strange.
Well, it's like, it's kind of like, and going back to what I was saying before, you know, I like that this is very much like an adult movie, which is kind of a weird thing to say, but
well, it's the same thing I talked about with like Prisoners and Sicario, and I don't know why I'm only thinking of Denis Villeneuve movies.
I don't know why either.
Yeah, you just don't get a lot of like movies that are like marketed at adults or like kids who don't want to be treated like children.
Right.
You know? Like, I can imagine being 14 and seeing this trailer and being like, that's it. That's my movie.
Right.
Screw Captain America. Screw everything else. That's the movie I want to see.
Exactly.
You know, there's nothing wrong with wanting to see like a childhood-ish film, unless it's a Transformers film. But like, yeah, wow. This is the movie that people like used to want, and I don't know if we don't want that anymore. But I want it. I want all of it.
Yeah, because like the 70s were like the heyday of, and a friend and I were talking about this because I was telling her about the film Parallax View, and she's like, I feel like there's not adult movies, like movies that are, because I mean, and this is like the infantilization of the 80s.
People say that a lot, and it kind of ruffles my feathers because...
Does it ruffle your feathers, Bill?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
My.
Another farm analogy, right?
This really gets my goat.
I don't know.
Jesus.
But it does kind of bug me. It does kind of bug me when people say that there aren't so-and-so kind of films, and it's because what they mean is they aren't playing on 3,000 screens every weekend. And it bugs me because there's so many films that come out every single year, and we're so aware of it because of our privileged position, but we're also aware of it because we're into it. And it sucks to realize some people have this, you know, it's like if someone was drinking a Bud Light and they're like, man, this beer sucks. Beer in America is pitiful. And you're like, well, then quit drinking Bud Light. Like, what are you doing to yourself?
I get it. Because it's like people are always like, oh, domestic beer, that's terrible. But what they really mean is Bud and Coors and Miller. Whereas if you were to go for like a Flying Dog, or if you're into IPAs, I guess Goose Island would be fine. But you could also do like a Stone or something like that. Like
Goose Island,
good stuff
give us some
there.
Sponsorship.
Yeah, there are so many good. You know, Sicario just didn't make a lot of money, right?
I know, but like, and it's weird. No. People complain about that all the time, but it's like, dude, it's right there. Like,
but you have to think, like, you have to think a movie
so
like
see a similar
The French
thing with
Connection.
Nice guys, I'm sure.
Yeah, but if you have to think like the movie like The French Connection would have made a lot of money in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. But a movie like that now,
no,
probably
it's definitely, it's a shift in the culture. And
it's a shift.
It's
that's my point.
I don't know if it's the rise of the man child.
It's the PG-13 culture. That's what it is.
Right. And it's,
but even
it's
in the
just,
90s, it wasn't that pronounced, you know?
No. No, I wouldn't say. Well, I think the 90s was, I think the 90s was still pretty, like, infantile, but in a different way.
Yeah.
Because a lot of, like, teen rom-coms were so huge in the 90s, whereas, like, now they're not so much. But, yeah, it's just this thing where it's, like, you look back at, like, what was the most prominent type of film.
Sure, sure.
A certain era. And it's like, why is this not? Because like you said before, Brian, this
like
is
Kramer
a movie.
Versus Kramer made a shit ton of money.
Yeah, exactly. Like you have to think like, would that wouldn't make that much money now? Well, like you, and it's crazy because it's like you said, Brian, this is a movie in which an 11-year-old, well, technically 13, I think they're 13, a 13-year-old girl gets thrown through a plate glass window, where you know, and it's shocking to see that because yeah. like, but in the reality, like that's the reality of the film. But it's still kind of shocking because, like, you just wouldn't see that because people would get offended or get, like, it would just be not marketable.
I actually saw people on Twitter getting offended about that.
What?
So stupid.
Look, Twitter's so a terrible stupid. Place. Follow us on Twitter, at Film
Studio.
Make
I'm
Twitter
sorry.
Great again.
I just can't, like, and I mean, there are things, like, it's one thing to, when it's something, like, so egregious where it's like, oh, God, this is, like, the just, like, what this, like, the message this is sending is, like, so disgusting. But, right. like, yeah. This is, you're talking about a hitman, like a bloodthirsty hitman who everyone fears throw
John
it like,
Boy.
Yeah, yeah. John named John Boy, named after a character from the Waltons, which is just delightful. But yeah. And I think that's the thing where it's just like in the 1970s, you know, there are people who get, that's the other thing about this movie.
Fucking Assault in Precinct 13, which I brought up earlier, opens with a little girl getting shot in an ice cream truck.
Right, that happened all the time because, like, that is violence. Like, violence isn't—it's not picking and choosing. And that's the thing about this movie too. So many people get killed in the background, and they don't say anything about it until the very end. Like,
nobody got hurt. Well, a couple people got.
Like
hurt.
That woman gets shot.
I think they got.
Poor woman.
Oh my God! Yeah, that's
yeah.
yeah.
I remember
shot
watching
the
that and being like
the alley.
I didn't know if she actually got shot or
no, she
or
got
she
shot.
Just,
she got shot.
Or
man.
She was
like
just reacting to the fact that like a bullet just came through the window.
Oh no!
And like
she got shot.
She like dodged it.
She got
I don't know.
Shot.
No, she got okay. shot. She didn't
real,
dodge
real
that.
Shot up in there.
They didn't touch on that again at all. And I was like,
but
what happened
was
to that woman?
Scene where someone else got shot in the background. But yeah, you're right. There's a lot. There's a through line of like, oops.
Where it's yeah. like so many like people are getting hit by stray bullets and it's all these casualties and no one and they're just like, well, they just they didn't get hurt. They just died.
I think they died quickly, though, so they weren't hurt.
and it's, you know, and that's such a bold thing to do and to say in a movie where in a time when, like you were saying before, Bill, like you have friends who won't watch movies if a dog dies in the movie mm-hmm. or if an animal yeah. gets hurt, where it's like. That's what we're coming up against is like people who are like, no, I am afraid to like, you know, it's just like,
that's
this
great.
Is...
Amanda, this helps me talk about what my pet project is. Safe spaces and the liberal feminization of America. We need
Anyways,
to make America.
Brian, one thing I want to give this credit or give this film.
I know you're joking, but still.
I am joking.
I know you're
yes.
joking.
One thing I want to give this film a lot of credit for is actually the Amelia plot, the underpinnings of it, because her whole agenda in this is to basically unravel this kind of conspiracy that the auto industry is basically covering up research and facts and you know trying to keep the catalytic converters out of cars and things like that. And what she does is she makes a porno. She teams up with this famous porn star named Misty Mountains and her producer, Sid Sat. What's his name?
Shattuck.
Yeah.
And her reasoning is actually both illogical and logical. It makes so much sense in a very sad way because what she's
like
saying
sex
is.
Sells.
Yeah, she's saying sex sells, and this is why, like, I had to team up with someone that was willing to put money behind this project that probably didn't give a shit about the project, but was like, oh, like you get, I get to make a film with Misty Mountains, my collaborator, and this new girl, Amelia. Cool. And, you know, I'm sure she probably sold herself, you know, this is all background, but I'm sure she probably sold herself as, hey, you know, that, that big government agency that's coming down on the auto industry. Yeah. I'm that girl's or woman's daughter. Right. And okay. So all of a sudden you're like, oh, shit.
Not a girl.
Yeah. Yeah.
She is a mature woman.
Yes, not anymore. Yes. Anyways. And so, yeah, it's exactly right, Amanda. It's like she's both admitting that sex sells and also saying, but if there's a message that I can actually get through while using sex, I'm going to use it, because that's the only way I can figure out a way to actually make this work. And it's both sad.
It's really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting way to.
It would be such an easy thing to have this kind of plot thread. And I criticized it earlier that it feels kind of in your face. And I still stand by that criticism yeah. in points, because it is very heavy handed. But what it actually is saying, I think, is very, very intelligent and smart. I think the way it's integrated is part of the way it's integrated into the movie, and the way the movie kind of is a reflection of, it's just this kind of crazy screwball comedy. And so it's all these things kind of thrown together, right? And that's kind of how it feels. But if you dig a little bit deeper, I think it works a lot better once you start to realize some of the nuts and bolts that they put together behind the scenes.
Right. It's very well thought out. I mean, it's
a Shane Black film.
Because it also pulls in a lot of the changing, like how we viewed sex in the 70s, where it was sort of like post free love movement, where porn was actually like seen as like, you know, you could go watch Deep Throat in like a regular theater. Like people were viewing Deep Throat, and like it was just the idea of like how people were looking at sex and how porn became very prominent. And, you know, you look at like Times Square, and like Times Square was basically nothing but porn theaters. You know, it's just one of those, it's just like the way they take that, like that culture and spin it into basically like part of the plot. I mean, it's just, actually she says something like she did it with, like, she never actually has sex in the movie. It's like her and her boyfriend.
Yes.
I'm trying to remember.
They never really kind of fully follow through on like what she actually does. Because,
well, hopefully
the
that
other
porn
thing
is part of the DVD features.
I was about to say, because
it's like,
thing
how
is,
do you like my you car,
even,
big boy?
Yeah, you don't even see the actual porn, and you're like, you don't actually get to see,
I wanted to
some
see that
of the,
porn.
Some
I
of the
not
message.
Want to see that porn. Like, 70s porn is gross.
I wanted to see like some of like how they were going to integrate some of the message, and beyond just the obvious, like there's this stand in for.
No,
for,
it's literally just,
you know,
that,
the
Bill.
Industry.
Like you're looking for a lot of nuance in a porn that has a plot.
Well, I thought that was the point of the film.
No, the point of the film was literally like, we'll rope people in with the sex, and then we'll just have a point where someone says what's wrong with it. What's wrong with the cars, not the sex.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a way of getting people's attention, obviously, but, you know, and like the way, and like I said before, this is going back to like women not being victims in this movie, but actually being like competent, savvy figures. And I think that's just like a really interesting take, considering like where, like what this is influenced by.
Indeed.
Anyway.
All right. Well, that is it for today. Thank you for joining us, everyone. Join us next week. We'll be talking about maybe The Lobster. I know we said we were doing that this week, but
did we?
It's not expanding.
Well,
yeah,
it's not.
Last
yeah.
weekend, I said we would do The Lobster this weekend.
Oh, I don't remember
it's
last
not
weekend
everywhere yet. So, until then, let's tell the fine folks at home where we can be found. Bill Graham.
You can find me at CableBFG on Twitter, and you can find me on the film stage writing about movies.
All right, Amanda Waltz.
You can find me on Twitter at Media Waltz, also Media Waltz on Letterboxd, and you can also find my blog, Steel Cinema, on WordPress.
All right, and you can find me on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan. That's really where all my social media accounts are, because, again, I'm not a clever or creative man. And you can find me writing reviews at filmstage.com. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. Tune in next time.